Less he knew, the safer he would be. Then scrolled through the phone and dialed a different number. "Officer Brown," said the voice at the other end. "Hey, James, this is Tamika Mars."
"Mars?" he said. He sounded surprised. "To what do I owe the pleasure?"
"That case you were working when I saw you this morning," she said. "You got a name for the victim?"
"Not yet. Whoever shot him took his wallet. Why?"
"Try Jersey Aaron Stern," she said,
her eyes on the passenger seat where the battered book sat.
"Yeah?" he replied. "Why?"
"Just a hunch." "The city has 8.5 million people," he said. "That's quite a hunch."
"Yeah," she said,
her voice edged with something like sadness.
"He wasn't from around here. I'll check in, James."
She turned the phone off and took the battery out. When she spotted a Radio Shack, she parked illegally, ducked inside, and bought 2 burner phones with $100 on each. One she pocketed. After she recorded the number for the second phone, she brandished it in her hand as she flagged down a cab. She moved alongside the driver's window.
"Are you getting in or what?" said the turbaned driver.
She handed him the burner.
"You know Joe's on 13th?
"This is a cab, not a courier service," said the cabbie.
"And this is a $50 bill,"
she returned. It was turning into an expensive day.
"Ask for Marvin or Audrey. No one else."
The taxi pulled away, and she returned to Dion's vehicle. It was time to hit the road. But the road to where? She didn't know, but it would be a good start if she put some distance between herself and the city. She took Canal Street to the Holland Tunnel and Interstate 78, heading west, her hands firm on the wheel, her mind turning events over and over, like a spade in dark earth. Jersey Stern's journey, and it had been a long and strange one, was over. Hers was just beginning.
14. Jersey, Poland, 1944.
With Ishmael gone, and the machine guns around the perimeter firing at me, it took no great courage to crawl through the fence and sprint blindly across the minefield. I went around the first mine I saw and leapt over another, but I barely cared. Inside, I was already dead. That I made it to the tree line was, I suppose, a matter of extraordinary good luck, but I felt no relief or satisfaction. My brother, my dearest companion, my sole friend in all the world, the final remnant of my family and last piece of what my life had been, was dead, and I could feel nothing but grief and rage and loss. They came after me, but the woods were dense and the ground too hard for tracks. Once I heard dogs, but for whatever reason, they did not pick up my scent. And after the first day, I never heard them again. Perhaps the strange experiments in the mine had confused the hound's senses, as old Eisenberg had said. I escaped. A bleak triumph it was. I had nothing to wear but the clothes I'd woken up in, inadequate for a Polish winter. The best thing that could be said about my meager rations is that I was used to going hungry. For the first 2 days, I kept walking in what I thought was a straight line, just trying to get away from the camp. From time to time I could hear the sounds of a train, but knew that trying to stow away on board would surely get me caught. And even if the trains didn't go back to the camps, where was I to go? It was not as if I could take a locomotive to Switzerland. I was safer alone in the woods. I slept in a hollow tree beside a frozen stream that first night, and woke so weak for lack of food that I determined to find the village I had heard the guards talk of, Ludwigowice. I dared not talk to anyone, since no one could be trusted not to turn me over to the Nazis merely for an increase of their butter rations. But I hoped to find larders or fields from which I might steal, or smokehouses I could plunder after dark. I walked for hours, disoriented by grief, hunger, and the strange uniformity of the forest. Eventually I realized that I had traced a broad circle, arriving back almost where I had begun.
demoralized to the point of despair. I lay down again and would have slept, were it not for a pair of rabbits not 20 yards away. I had not eaten meat in over a year, and the thought of trapping and eating them gave me the energy to get up and stay awake. Looking back, I think those rabbits may have saved my life, though I had neither the skill nor the tools to catch them. I was succumbing to cold, hunger, and exhaustion, and had I gone to sleep then, I think I would never have awoken. Instead, I ate some snow and ice, then followed the loping rabbits through the snow, and came to a spot where I could smell wood smoke. 100 yards ahead, the trees seemed to thin, and though I was almost crawling by then, I found myself looking down on the houses of a village. One of them had a shed in the small field at the back. I was able to make my way down, fairly sure that I had not been seen. The door to the shed was unlocked, and I slipped inside, glad to get out of the wind. Inside were rusty farm implements, old tools, bags of seeds, and, to my astonishment and joy, a sack of potatoes. I rubbed the dirt off their skins and ate 4 uncooked, filling my belly as it had not been for years, then washed it down with bitter rainwater from a barrel and curled up on the shed's wooden floor. I don't know how long I slept. When I awoke, it was dark, and there was an apple beside my head. For a long moment, I lay there looking at it, marveling not that I had food, but that someone had seen me and not killed me or turned me over to those who would. It was a gift from God, and it fed my bruised and broken soul. When I found a knife in one of the tool crates, I cut the apple in half, then in quarters. I ate 1 quarter, put 2 in my pockets, and left the 4th exactly where the apple had been, then crept out into the cold night, running bent over into the blackness of the forest. For an hour, I wandered the woods, always keeping a sense of how close I was to the village, listening to the soft hoot of the big gray owls that haunted the forest. Then I found a hollow stick and used the knife I had borrowed from the shed to peel off the bark. I whittled one end and made a few small holes so that when you blew in one end, the pipe made a low, reedy note, not unlike the owl's. I ate what was left of my apple, and then, when the moon sank and dawn was near, returned to the garden shed on the edge of the village. I left the pipe I'd made outside the door in payment for my lodging, then crept inside and went to sleep. For 10 days, this was how I lived, hiding out in the woods at night, sleeping in the shed during the day, leaving whatever meager tokens I could find or fashion in the forest, in the desperate hope that whoever owned the shed would not turn me in. Each day, I woke to some small gift of food, sometimes a piece of bread, sometimes a hunk of cheese, once a leg of cold goat meat, which was the most delicious thing I had ever tasted. They never brought pork, and though I had peeled the yellow star off my jacket, its shape was still visible. 2x I considered lying awake to see who my secret benefactor was, but decided against it. I was in a fairy story, and spying would only break the spell. I had had enough reality for a lifetime. One day, I woke to find a piece of candied fruit wrapped with a ribbon, and with it, a candle and matches. Hanukkah had passed uncelebrated. The memory of all I had lost was like a great weight on my chest, but I wept tears of gratitude for the candy and the candle, and the fact that someone wanted me to be happy. Soon after that, as we crossed into the new year, I started to hear the rumble of what I first thought was thunder, but which turned out to be guns. The Russians were coming. I didn't know it yet, but much of eastern Poland had already fallen before them, and though Lower Silesia would fight on for another month or so, the Germans were pulling out of the Wenceslas mine. in spite of the harrying by Allied bombers. The trains seemed to be running constantly. One day, as I wandered the edge of the woods, not so very far from the minefield and the fenced henge where Ishmael had died, I came across a work detail clearing an old airstrip of weeds. I kept my distance, fighting the urge to sprint headlong into the trees and never look back, and watched them work until a pair of trucks and a half-track came to collect them. Before they left, they inspected the strip, and when the officer in charge turned and squinted down the pale concrete, I saw his face and knew him. It was Ungerleider, the handsome blonde captain who had ordered the guns to fire upon us when we had finished rigging the cables above the chamber with the bell. It was the man who killed my brother. I got to my feet, trembling with a rage that left me incapable of thought. I stepped out of the trees, just as he turned away and clambered into the half-track. Shouting at him, I began to run blindly, stupidly toward him. The engines drowned out my cries, thank God, and by the time I had come to my senses, they were driving away, their wheels spitting snow. I stood staring after them, tears running down my cheeks. Gradually, I realized how cold I was, and went back into the woods. I now knew its paths and hollows as well as any house I had ever lived in. But as I walked back toward the village and the shed that had become my home, my outrage turned to grim determination. I did not know how, but I would find a way to strike back at that man for what he had done to my people and, most importantly, to my brother. That night, instead of roaming the woods, I went quietly to the house by the shed where I had been sleeping. When I was sure there were no neighbors to see me, I went quickly to the back door and knocked. I had no idea who would answer. Still, I was surprised when an elderly lady in a housecoat and apron opened the door. She looked not the least bit surprised or upset, her face neutral as she looked me up and down, and then she stood aside, peering over my shoulder as she admitted me to a stark, scrubbed kitchen. Satisfied we had not been seen, she closed the door behind me and looked me over again. "Too cold for the woods tonight?" she asked in Polish. "No," I said. "I came to say thank you." She considered this. "Sit," she said. "I have cocoa, powdered, no milk, but it is hot and sweet." I did as I was told. "You were in the mine?" she said, not looking at me. "Yes, ma'am." "Just you, or you had family there?" I opened my mouth to speak, and found I could not. Since the moment my brother died, I had not spoken a word to another person. I stared at her, my eyes brimming with tears, shaking my head, and stammering apologies. She did not embrace me, but she laid her hands on my shoulders, and put her face close to mine, and shushed me softly, as Ishmael might have done. So that, for a long time, I just sat there, weeping. "What is your name, child?" she asked at last. I hadn't thought of myself as a child for a long time, and not only because I was now almost 15. That dried my tears. "Jersey," I said. "German?" she asked. "Polish," I said. She managed a half-smile then. "Welcome, Jersey," she said. "I am Mrs. Habenicht, a name that has made the last 5 years a fraction easier around here. But you can call me Olga. My husband was German. Thank the Lord he died before all this," she said, breaking from me and bustling about the kitchen as she prepared the cocoa. "They are leaving," I said. "Soon," she said. "Yes." Something in my face gave me away. She thrust the cup into my hands with a scowl. "And you want revenge before they go?" "Yes," I said, my former bitter anger returning, so that the single word yes had a hardness and certainty I had not believed myself capable of. She nodded thoughtfully. Understandable, she concluded. The army will be here soon. The Russians? I asked. I didn't like the idea. The Russians scared me. Before the war, my father had said it was only a matter of time before they came, with or without the German support. She shook her head dismissively. The Polish army, she exclaimed. They have been fighting in the east. They would have liberated Warsaw if the Reds had delivered on their promises. They will be here soon. Then we shall see. There are things in the mine, I began, uncertain. Dangerous things. The Germans will try to get them out. She sipped her cocoa, and I imitated her. It was the most delicious thing I had tasted in years. Planning a little sabotage, eh? She said. Yes, I agreed, though I hadn't been until that moment. She nodded again, and I wondered if she might be a little bit crazy. We shall have to see about that, she said.
15. Alan. Camp Leatherneck Marine, Helmand Province, Afghanistan. The unsigned resignation letter sat in his inside pocket as the C-130J took off from Leatherneck. Hatcher hadn't asked for it, but as they took their seats, Alan's jacket had bulged, and the CIA man had smiled that distant private smile of his and said nothing. Alan had flown in C-130s modified to feel more like a civilian aircraft, with plush forward-facing seats. But this was a conventional troop flight operated by VMGR 252 that, in a series of hops, would eventually wend its way back to Cherry Point, North Carolina. The trip would refuel in Suda Bay, Greece, as long as they eventually made it stateside, or to wherever they had been fragged. The troops on board didn't seem to care. Alan was edgy. He didn't like not knowing what was going on. He sat in one of the red mesh troop seats that lined the bare fuselage walls, facing into the body of the aircraft, where the luggage had been strapped to a plastic-wrapped pallet. The airplane was basic and functional. If there was any question that they were in a military plane, in what was still technically a combat zone, the takeoff removed any doubt. Instead of the slow and graceful climb to altitude civilians enjoyed, the C-130J pulled up on a great stomach-churning surge, like a roller coaster car clanking up to its highest point, but at 120 knots and accelerating. There had been no hostile fire on flights from Air Base Naya in months, but the pilot was taking no chances. As the nose rose still higher, Alan tipped sideways in his seat. He gave Hatcher a sidelong glance, but if the gut-spinning climb was bothering the other man, he wasn't letting it show. Alan closed his eyes. There were no windows, nothing to look at but the men sitting opposite him, and he had long since mastered the ability to sleep through the most turbulent of flights, but his mind was racing. He hadn't signed the letter of resignation, but even that token gesture of defiance was little more than a delaying tactic, while he waited to see what he was really being offered. Hatcher had told him nothing, beyond dangling a few vague and slightly mystical phrases, smiling cryptically and, more to the point, silently, when Alan pressed him for details. He would be fully briefed when he committed to the program, not before. It wasn't like he had a lot of options. But a dawn flight out of Afghanistan felt strange, like he was sneaking out. It didn't sit right with him, and a part of Alan felt that Hatcher was playing games with him, with his hints about strange aircraft. Sign this, he had said, and I'll show you. Alan shifted in his seat, trying to hold on to his outrage and his skepticism. But part of him was curious and nervous, the way a child feels, cautiously cranking the handle of a jack-in-the-box. Around him, sleepy Marines nodded along to the tinny music that leaked out of their headphones and earbuds. Some played video games on their phones or tablets. Others thumbed through magazines. Two had thrown up, and several others were looking green.
but there was still an overall sense of relief. They were going home. Alan didn't know where he was going. If they were heading to Cherry Point, or even to the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, they would fly through D.C. When they touched down, not in Greece, but in Kuwait, he and Hatcher were the only passengers to disembark. There, they were met by a bald man in a suit who shook Hatcher's hand and introduced himself to Alan as Agent Harvey Kenyon. His handshake was firm and dry, his manner brisk as he directed them to a solitary Gulfstream jet parked in a hardened shell just off the tarmac. "You can get aboard. We're just waiting for one more." Alan took his seat. After the C-130, this was luxury itself. The Gulfstream's sleek and polished interior, more posh and expensive than anything Alan had flown lately. And for all its luxury, nothing like his fun. "Where are we heading?" he asked, as Hatcher settled into the seat across the aisle and took out an iPad. "Did you sign the letter yet, Major?" he replied, not taking his eyes off the screen in front of him. "Not yet," said Alan. "You're going to want to do so," said Hatcher, "or we won't be taking you any further." His tone was abstracted, as if he were thinking of other things, but it had a finality to it that left Alan irritated. He turned away so that the CIA men now that Kenyon was standing in the doorway, wouldn't see the color rise in his face, and said nothing. Then a final passenger boarded. "Major," said the asset known as Marat, "we seem to keep crossing paths, don't we?" He tossed a non-regulation duffel bag onto the seat behind Alan and dropped into the chair next to it. "You're heading to Langley too, huh?" asked Alan. There was a momentary pause as Marat looked at Hatcher, who was studiously ignoring them both. "Not unless they're planning on giving me a parachute," Marat said. "We're not going to Langley?" Alan asked. "Until you sign that document in your pocket," Hatcher said, still not looking up. "Our destination is classified." Alan frowned. The aircraft was a Gulfstream G650, designed for both speed and extreme range. They could reach a lot of places without stopping to refuel. Marat grinned and rolled his eyes. "CIA man," he muttered to Alan, "we do like our little games. What's your position exactly?" "Mr. Marat's identity and occupation are likewise classified," said Hatcher, deadpan. And that, it seemed, was that. After years of being inside the loop, of being not just informed, but consulted, his opinion solicited, Alan was now to be treated like a raw recruit, a know-nothing who couldn't be trusted with the most basic piece of intel. "Guess I'll see you in the morning," said Marat, "whenever the hell that is." Marat turned his shoulder in toward the window and pulled the blind down. "Okay, Major," said Hatcher. He was standing over him, a ballpoint pen in one hand. "We're ready to close the door and get out of here. This is your last chance. Sign your letter to the Marine Corps, or this is as far as we go." For all the earlier back and forth, Hatcher seemed quite serious. Alan plucked the letter from his pocket and considered it. He was a Marine. If he stopped being one, what would be left of him? Who would he be? "Where are we going?" Alan asked, stalling. "Okay," Hatcher said with a shrug and a half smile. "We're going to Groom Lake, Nevada, a.k.a. Homey Airport, a.k.a. Dreamland, a.k.a. Paradise Ranch, a.k.a. Watertown, a.k.a. Area 51, Alan completed for him, suddenly wide awake. Hatcher gave him that fractional knowing smile again. "That's an Air Force base," said Alan. "Parts of it," said Hatcher. "I'm operations director for a separate portion. Special aircraft development and testing." "Want to see what we've got?" he asked, his voice low, almost teasing. "Sign here." Alan blinked and signed. Alan was shaken awake by Hatcher. The flight had been uneventful, and for all his unease, exhaustion had got the better of him, 2/3 of the way into the flight. It was unlike him to sleep through a landing, but that was what seemed to have happened. He awoke groggy
his mouth dry, with an ache in the small of his back. Hatcher was the only person still aboard. The Gulfstream's cabin door was closed, and all the window shades were down. In a half daze, born of exhaustion and the enormity of his resignation from the Marine Corps, Alan followed Hatcher down the steps to the airfield. The runway was lined with blast-hardened hangars and concrete buildings, the base nondescript, except for the eerie quiet and the parked buses with the blacked-out windows. A Humvee barreled towards them from the direction of the air traffic control tower, throwing up a rooster tail of sand and dust. A soldier in the gunport, half suspended in his five-point harness, manned a massive 50-caliber machine gun. Alan gave Hatcher a look. "Easy, Major," he said. "Just routine." "I'm still a major? Would you rather be called agent?" Alan thought quickly and shook his head. "Then major it is," said Hatcher. The Humvee pulled up some 20 yards short, and the driver got out, careful to keep out of the 50 cal's field of fire. Hatcher held up his badge in one hand and the iPad in the other. The soldier checked the ID and took the tablet back to the Humvee, where he made a phone call while he checked the mobile data terminal mounted on the vehicle's passenger side. Alan waited, conscious of the vast and silent blue of the Nevada desert sky above him, and of the eyes of the man watching him down the barrel of the machine gun. Overhead, a hawk called, high and shrill. The soldier returned Hatcher's thanks to him. "That seems to be an order, sir," he said. "Sorry for making you wait. We have inbound in 3 minutes. Anyone below level 7 must avert." "I'm granting the major here clearance level 7 on a temporary basis," Hatcher said. The soldier hesitated. "Temporary, sir?" he said. "For how long?" 5 minutes ought to do it," Hatcher said. "Understood, sir," said the soldier. Not by me, thought Alan. What was the point of being granted 5 minutes of high-security clearance? "This way, please, gentlemen," said the soldier, motioning them into the Humvee. Hatcher sat up front, Alan in the back. He nodded an uncertain greeting to the machine gunner, but the other man did not respond. They drove towards the control tower, and then the air was torn apart by the shriek of a pulsing high-pitched siren. Red lights flashed in sync with the noise. In the distance, two uniformed men lay face down on the ground, hands around their heads. "What the hell?" Alan began. But his words died on his lips. All over the base, men were doing the same, either dashing into buildings or lying down in the dust and sand, arms over their heads. They weren't taking cover. They were effectively blindfolding themselves. It was so strange, so mesmerizing, that for a moment, Alan did not see the ship. It came out of nowhere, soundless, slipping through the air so easily that it was as if it had always been there, and he'd just noticed it. But that couldn't be. Nothing about the ship could be. Except, of course, that he had seen it, or something like it, only a few nights before. 16. Jennifer, London. The business suit felt ridiculous. The pencil skirt hugged her thighs so closely that she had to take tiny steps, though in her absurd high heels it was no great loss, given that she could barely walk. "No wonder women don't get anywhere in business," she muttered to her reflection. "It takes them twice as long to go anywhere." "I think you look most professional," said Deacon, sweeping an invisible fleck of lint from her shoulders with a brush apparently designed for the purpose. He considered the elegant French twist, which had taken her a maddening half hour, and adjusted a flyaway strand of hair. "I think I look like an impostor," said Jennifer, "and so will everyone else." It had been 3 days since the reading of the will. Jennifer had stalled as best she could, asking Deacon to deflect all phone calls and requests for informal meetings, on the grounds of bereavement, but she was only postponing the inevitable. When she was told of the scheduled meeting of the Maynard Consortium's executive board, she knew she would have to go.
"Wouldn't Biss rather begin with one of the less, formidable bodies?" Deacon suggested. "A museum board or charitable trust, for instance. Dip your toes in, as it were. The men in the Maynard group are powerful."
"I'm powerful," she said, not really believing it. "My father's will made me so."
"But you are also new to the world of finance," Deacon said gently. "These men take no quarter. I recommend you get your feet wet in rather less dangerous waters."
"Maybe I'll just cannonball into the pool and see how they handle it," she said.
"At the risk of belaboring the metaphor," Deacon replied, "I think it's less of a pool and more of a piranha tank."
"Then I'll be the shark," she said, determined to stay upbeat. Deacon frowned.
"Do sharks eat piranhas?" he mused. "I believe piranhas are freshwater fish."
"Let's leave the marine biology lessons for another day, shall we, Deacon?"
"As you wish, miss," said the older man, with his patented gesture of acknowledgment. A fraction more than a nod. A fraction less than a bow. Head tilted slightly, eyes almost closed for a moment. "Then I will find you the consortium's latest reports. If after perusing them you want to delay the meeting..."
"I won't."
"As you say, miss."
She sounded so confident, so sure of herself and her capacity to blend in. All that changed once she began to pore over the consortium's various printouts and quarterly reports. Bafflingly, her father's computer files seemed to contain nothing on the Maynard Group, despite it being his primary financial concern. So she had little that was personal to guide her through the publicity hype and acronym-cluttered business speak. Deacon brought her tea in a china cup, and politely said nothing as she plowed through a hefty dictionary for phrases like iterative empowerment, backward compatibility, and angel investors. Jennifer sipped absently, recognized the delicate aroma of Earl Grey, and looked up.
"What in God's name does it mean if a company has," she checked the brochure,
"a little-known equity tail to its bond-managing body?"
"Perhaps we should start at the beginning," said Deacon.
A day later, she was still learning. Jennifer had been up half the night, getting Deacon's crash course in global finance, though, as was always the case with complex information, the result had been to teach her how little she understood about the world. She had gone to bed with a raging headache and the nagging certainty that she would make a fool of herself at the board meeting, business suit or no business suit. She had managed to squeeze in a morning run along the hedgerowed lanes of her childhood, but it hadn't been nearly enough to burn off all her pent-up agitation. Now she forced herself to sit still in the car, feeling the time tick by as they idled in the gridlock of central London.
"This is why we should have used the helicopter," Deacon remarked.
"Because the day wasn't sufficiently traumatic?" Jennifer shot back. She was starting to feel nauseated.
"You are so like your father," he remarked.
It wasn't a compliment, and she gave him a sharp look, though she didn't have the energy to argue the point, ludicrous though it was. They passed the pale, restrained decorum of the Bank of England on Threadneedle Street, and were soon in sight of Paternoster Square and the London Stock Exchange. Jennifer spent her time checking off the headquarters of companies that, in recent years, she had come to think of as the enemy. Lloyd's, Old Mutual, Prudential, Ernst & Young, Standard Charter. This was her father's world, the world of suits and limousines, though whether she was entering as a spy, full of hostile intent, or defector, she really wasn't sure. Something else was on her mind as well. In her largely futile attempt to prepare for the day's meeting, Jennifer had scoured her father's files for details of his work with the Maynard Group, and had come up empty. And while she first thought this merely annoying, she soon realized that it was rather more than that. It was strange. It made no sense. The Maynard Consortium had been a huge part of her father's life. Why would there be no trace of it after his death? A solution seemed to present itself when Deacon pointed out that all the Maynard data was on a separate laptop he kept in his study when he wasn't traveling. But when she looked for the laptop, it wasn't there. Jennifer stopped fiddling with her French twist, flexed her fingers until the knuckles cracked, and stared out of the rain-misted car windows at the orderly facades of the city offices. Maybe the laptop had just been misplaced. Maybe it would turn up when she and the lawyers cataloged her father's things. Or maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it was gone, spirited away by whomever had stood there in his study the day her father, inexplicably, impossibly, threw himself off the balcony. The police investigation had been perfunctory at best, and that, it now occurred to her, was worrying. Her father had been a powerful man who dealt with vast amounts of money. The possibility that someone who ran in the same circles might have been able to influence the inquiry into his death was all too plausible. Who that might have been, and why he had killed her father, if that was what had happened, she had no idea. But a thought was forming in one of the dark corners of her mind, something strange and shapeless and terrible to look at, something, she felt sure, that involved the Maynard Consortium. Deacon checked his watch as they boarded the sleek steel elevator and gave her a look. "Might I offer a piece of advice, Miss Jennifer?" he asked. In other circumstances, the question might have irritated her, but she was rattled by how clearly out of her depth she was, and nodded. "Be polite," said Deacon. "Accept their condolences gratefully. Then just listen. Most of what they discuss will be baffling, and all of it will be tedious. So just keep calm, and we'll review after we've determined how long you are to stay involved in these meetings. Don't talk. You will only antagonize them and reveal how little you know. That will make it easier for them to outmaneuver you. Best to keep them guessing, as it were. Shut up, in other words." She nodded again, nausea swelling within her as the elevator slowed into position on the 23rd floor, and the doors opened. Deacon gave her a quick look and, as if seeing something in her eyes he didn't like, added, "Really, Miss Jennifer, this is not the time for you to take on the dominant social order or ask pointed questions about your father's death. Just sit still and listen." She held his eyes for a moment with a touch of resentment, but she knew he was right. It was going to take all her strength just to sit through the next couple of hours without being banned from the building. "And stop touching your hair," he added, smiling. "It looks fine." A secretary looked up from his desk, his bright professional smile faltering when he saw Jennifer, then checked Deacon. Something wordless passed between the two men, and the secretary rose, the professional smile back in place. "Miss Quinn," he said, standing up but seeming unsure as if he should reach out to shake her hand. "Welcome. Please follow me." She murmured a thank you, but the words stuck in her throat, and she didn't think he heard her. She turned to Deacon, who gave her an encouraging smile. They followed the secretary, who stopped at a heavy door of lacquered wood and knocked deferentially, head cocked to catch the voices within. She didn't hear whatever made him turn the handle and push the door open, but that was partly the blood rushing in her ears as she tried to shut down the panic that was rising inside her. The room was bright, all windows onto the city, white walls and chrome furniture trimmed and padded in gray leather. There were a dozen chairs, all occupied by men she had seen at the reading of the will, save one. Hers. She walked to the chair with deliberate, confident strides, one hand in her pocket so no one would see it tremble, ignoring the way they rose minutely from their chairs, a minuscule show of politeness that only served to reemphasize that she was the only woman there. Just before she sat, Deacon lowered his head and, in a voice no louder than a breath, whispered, "Be polite. Listen." He addressed the table in general. I will await Miss Jennifer in the lobby.
Thank you, Deacon, said a white-haired man at the end of the table. And I'm sure I speak for the board when I say how grateful we are for your work easing the transition at this difficult time.
There was a rumble of agreement around the room, rich old Etonian accents murmuring, "Hear, hear." For all her anxiety, Jennifer had to bite her lip to keep from grinning at the absurdity of it all. Deacon eased out, and the door latched closed behind him. Jennifer shifted in her seat. The white-haired man called the meeting to order. This was Archibald St. James. She recognized that jolly countenance and the Basset Hound eyes from the pictures Deacon had provided the evening before to aid her preparation. He was the chairman of the board, though Jennifer did not think she had met him before. In fact, the only people she knew, beyond Deacon's improvised gallery of mugshots, were Herman Salzberg, the walking skeleton who had haunted her childhood dreams, and Ronald Harrington Smythe, spilling out of his tailored suit like oil from one of the tankers by which he had made his money. Of the rest, based on their names, accents, and appearances, she counted an American, two Germans, one Japanese, one who might have been Spanish or South American, and one Russian, all men. There was also the younger man with disheveled jet-black hair, whose name she did not know, but who had nodded to her when she fled the reading of the will. Compared to the others, he looked vibrant, athletic even, and his eyes, when they looked at her, were bright with curiosity and amusement. He reached across the table and offered his hand. "Daniel Latranche," he said. "Call me Dan. Everyone does." Jennifer took his hand and shook it, grateful for his deliberate welcome. "Pleased to meet you," she said. "Welcome to the lion's den," he whispered, grinning. His accent, unlike the others, was hard to pinpoint. There were Northern English vowels in there, but they were laid over something else, a different non-English rhythm. Italian, perhaps? French? Latrange sounded French. She looked away, busying herself with the attaché case she was having trouble opening. She scowled, trying to be inconspicuous, as she fumbled with the catches. Deacon had locked it and forgotten to give her the bloody key. "Miss Quinn," said St. James, giving her a look of labored patience, "is there a problem?" She blinked, momentarily frozen. For a moment, the room was still, and she felt their mood. They were satisfied that she was what they'd expected. Some were even a little bored by how right they'd been in their private whisperings before she'd arrived. Her fingers clenched, and in that instant, the briefcase clasps snapped open. She had been pulling the wrong way. There was another watchful pause, heavy with unspoken judgment, and then St. James continued.
"As I was saying, if you turn to the first item on the agenda..."
And the meeting began. It was, as Deacon had prophesied, dull stuff. Jennifer tried to keep up, but they frequently lapsed into the kind of jargon she had read in the printouts, language designed to exclude her. She quickly lost track of what was happening. When they voted on each item, she was the sole abstainer. The first time, it felt like a tiny act of honest defiance, but by the fifth time, it felt merely embarrassing. The sixth item on the agenda was an African investment package. Salzburg, the cadaver, mumbled his way through its details, and everyone nodded dutifully as they moved toward a vote.
"I'm sorry," said Jennifer. "Can I just make sure I'm clear on something?"
The room turned to stare at her, as if she were a cat who'd suddenly broken into song.
"Is there something you do not understand?" asked St. James,
the question containing a poisonous joke at her expense. The others smiled.
"No, I think I understand completely," she answered, stiffening. "I just want to be clear you do."
There was a subtle shift in the quality of the air, as they all bridled and adjusted. Only the young man with the black hair still seemed amused. I'm not sure I follow, said Salzburg, in his usual death rattle.
You seem to be moving a sizable investment into the extraction of crude oil from Chad, despite that country's failed state ranking, according to the Fund for Peace. With Bangladesh, it has been consistently rated one of the most corrupt political systems in the world.
It was Salzburg's turn to blink, but he rallied quickly.
I assure you, the oil fields are extremely well protected. I don't think it an especially risky investment.
Again, Jennifer cut in, you misunderstand me. I'm talking about the ethics of supporting, however indirectly, a deeply problematic regime with a record of tribalism, cronyism, and a history of abuse of presidential authority in matters of government.
I think you were overstating the case, said Salzburg, with a ghastly fake smile. I can assure you that our shareholders have no serious reservations about extrajudicial killings by government forces, Jennifer chipped in. What about rape of civilian women by members of the army and police? How do your shareholders feel about that?
Interference in the social infrastructure is not the matter at hand, Salzburg began, but Jennifer cut him off. To invest in a country that severely limits free speech and freedom of assembly, which imprisons gays and lesbians, and which permits its security forces to arrest political activists without cause, to operate with total immunity on matters of... Call the question.
It was St. James.
I beg your pardon? Jennifer said, turning to face the chairman. I'm moving that we proceed to a vote on the item, he said.
I understand that, Jennifer returned, but I haven't said my piece.
Seconded, said Salzburg, ignoring her. All in favor?
St. James asked levelly.
Jennifer's mouth dropped open.
Aye, said the room. No, Jennifer gasped. 11 in favor, 1 opposed, said St. James. Motion carries.
10, Latrange corrected. I abstain.
Are you sure? St. James asked pointedly. That would force us to table the motion.
Yes, I'm sure, said Latrange.
St. James' eyes lingered on him for a half second, then returned to his papers, on which he made a note, and, without looking up, said,
Very well. Motion tabled. Item 7, on the matter of the Greek currency.
Jennifer avoided Latrange's eyes. To show gratitude might make her look weak, so she focused her attention on Salzburg, whose skeletal face looked satisfied in ways she wanted to punch. He caught her eye and smiled, papery skin stretching wide around the thin mouth, eyes twinkling with pleasure at her defeat. For a moment, she was 10 years old again, hating him, wanting to run from any room that had him in it. For the next few minutes, as the burble of conversation went on around her, she sat rigid, hearing nothing, feeling only an old rage at everything the room represented, and toward the man whose death had put her there. Again she thought it, first as an outraged exclamation, and then, after a pause and a breath, as a real question. What had he been thinking? Was one of the men in this room involved in her father's death? It seemed impossible. In terms of what they did, they were, she was sure, global bullies. But if people died because of their decisions, it was indirectly, at a remote, untraceable distance. That was what made them so maddeningly respectable.
Item 8, said St. James, in that same monotonous drawl. Continuation of the Special Aerospace Initiative Package at current funding levels. Discussion?
Yes, said a man 2 seats down from her. His name was Justin Hadley Jones, though she knew little else about him.
I'd like to propose a friendly amendment to raise funding by 28% to counter currency exchange fluctuations. I have figures, if anyone would like to see them.
I think we trust your judgment, Justin, said St. James. All in favor of the proposal as amended.
Another rumble of A's. St. James hesitated a second, and his eyes fell on Jennifer.
Miss Quinn?
What?
She said, irritably pulling hairpins from her French twist.
Oh, abstain.
Motion carries. May I suggest a coffee break? We have rather a lot still to get through.
As they filed out,
Jennifer's heart sank. This was undermining the dominant world order? Investigating her father's death? How is it going? Asked Deacon, when he found her cradling a cup of rapidly cooling tea.
Awful. Ghastly. It's only the tedium that keeps me from killing them all, she added with a bleak smile.
Well, we can be grateful for that, said Deacon. By the way, we found your father's laptop. It was in the Jaguar.
Did he often leave it there?
Never, to my knowledge, said Deacon, his face carefully blank.
And he was planning to come to London by helicopter the day he died?
That is correct, said Deacon.
Jennifer nodded thoughtfully, realizing just in time that Latrange, Dan, had materialized at her elbow.
How are you holding up? He asked.
Let's just say it's not what I'm used to, she replied.
Indeed, and I can say that I sympathize with your vote against the African deal. It must be harder for you, having been on the ground, as it were, seeing the conditions there.
I wasn't in Chad or Nigeria, she said quickly, her irritation returning, and I didn't see you voting against it.
Her obvious hostility gave him pause. But he gave a sideways nod of understanding and said, I said I sympathized with your perspective. But there are others that sometimes take priority in a place like this.
I don't agree.
And I respect that. Perhaps at some point we can meet less formally to discuss it. You're asking me out? She said, staring at him.
Not at all, he said, still smiling genially. I just thought you might like the opportunity to discuss ways in which you might strengthen your position, or express yourself in ways men like this are more likely to listen to you.
Aren't you one of them? She said, voice hard with defiance.
I think if you got to know me, you'd see that it's rather more complex than that. You know, Mr. Latrange, I think I have all the complexity I can handle right now.
She said it with a stiff and final politeness. His nod of acceptance was also somehow a shrug of defeat, though he produced a business card from a silver case.
Should you change your mind, he said.
She pocketed the card without looking at it, and he left her. She found herself under Deacon's watchful gaze. She closed her eyes for a second and felt a little of the tension leech from her shoulders.
That was rude of me, wasn't it? She said. That is not for me to say, miss, said Deacon. But I would say that in this world, allies are to be nurtured.
Assuming you can trust them.
Trust has to be earned, Deacon agreed. But it sometimes begins with, as you might say, a leap of faith.
Jennifer sighed. The board members were drifting back into the meeting room.
Once more into the breach, said Deacon, taking her untouched tea from her. And please, stop fussing with your hair. It's annoying. It's professional. Same thing.
She followed the orders, closing the door behind her and taking her seat before she noticed that on her copy of the agenda, someone had underlined the last item they had approved in heavy black pen, Special Aerospace Initiative Package. She stared at it, then glanced around the room, in the hope that someone would give her a nod or a look that would acknowledge the curious message. If indeed that was what it was. But everyone was looking at St. James as he began to work his way through the rest of the scheduled items. It was as if they had forgotten she was there. Except that one of them hadn't. She was sure of it. Though what it meant, she had no idea.
17. Tamika, New Jersey. Just outside Springfield, New Jersey, Tamika pulled off the exit ramp and into a McDonald's parking lot, signed into their Wi-Fi on the burner phone, and typed Jersey Aaron Stern and New York into a series of search engines. Zaba Search, People, Wink, and Zoom Info, her usual snooping starters. She got no one in the right age group, which meant that either the name was false or he was new to the area. She widened the search from New York to the northeastern states, then the whole East Coast, and eventually to the whole country. Nothing. False name, then. No one could have that small a data footprint.
The police would have other tools, of course, but she had only given them the name. She called Officer Brown, but hung up when the call went to voicemail, then tried reaching the other burner phone, hoping the cappie had been as good as his word. If he hadn't, she had his license plate, though she doubted that would help. Marvin answered.
"What's going on?"
he whispered. "Can you talk? Without being overheard, I mean?" she asked.
"Sure. Where are you? How are you?"
"Okay, I'm fine. But I'm moving, and I don't want anyone to know where. So keep this number to yourself, and don't call anyone but me on that burner. Okay?"
"Okay.
I want you to see what you can find on a Jersey Aaron Stern. Jersey with a Z. He'd be in his 80s, I think."
"And the nature of this search?" asked Marvin.
"Discreet, but rigorous," said Tamika. That meant he'd be hacking, but covering his tracks as he went. He was good at that.
"On it," he said.
"Thanks, Marvin," she said. "I appreciate it."
"Look after yourself, boss," he said.
"Planning to." She paid cash at the drive-thru and began working on a quarter pounder with cheese like she was 12, taking a large bite and wondering vaguely when she'd last permitted herself such an indulgence. "Yeah, well," she thought, "get shot at. Win a burger." She forced herself to chew slowly, deliberately putting the wrapped sandwich down when she was halfway through. She reached for Stern's ancient journal on the passenger seat and flipped the front cover. Under his name was an address in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. She considered it, picked up her phone, then opted to go old school, dragging a dog-eared atlas from the glove box and onto her lap. Pottsville was not far off 78, west of Allentown. She pushed the French fry into her mouth and wondered what the hell she was doing, or what she hoped to find. 60 miles, give or take, she said aloud. It didn't sound too far, assuming the Corolla was up to it. She turned the engine over and pulled back onto the interstate heading west. The day was warming as she left the city behind. Some of the trees showed the buds of new leaves. Spring at last, she thought, deciding to take that as a good sign. She came off the highway at the Pottsville exit and, weary of turning her phone back on, stopped at a mobile station for directions. They led her through the center of town and into the surrounding hills. As she drove, she saw no black people and few cars significantly fancier than Dion's. The gated community at the top of the hill was, therefore, a surprise. It was called The Hollows, set back from the road, surrounded by trees next to a golf course. But the wrought iron fence edging the property looked more than ornamental. Tamika drove slowly past the security gate, then parked just beyond a row of closely planted Leland cypress, carefully manicured and dense as a wall. She got out and walked back. She considered pressing the buzzer by the electric gate. There was something strange about the place, its remoteness and its unexpected opulence. That gave her pause. As she looked, a man emerged from a sentry box inside the gate. He was uniformed in black, and was younger and more athletic than she expected. "Can I help you?" he asked. The words held no welcome. "I'm here to see Mr. Stern," she answered. "Mr. Jersey Stern." The guard's face remained expressionless. "I think you have the wrong development," he said. "There's no Stern here." "You know all your residents' names?" asked Tamika, trying to sound playful rather than confrontational. "I do," he answered, unsmiling. The bulge under his sweater pulled down over his waistband suggested he was armed. "Is there anything else?"
"If this is the wrong place, perhaps you can point me in the right direction," she said, still trying to sound sweet. 1094 Poplar Road.
"That's here," said the guard, still giving nothing away. "You must have gotten it wrong. Where did you get the address?" And now she knew she was in the right place. He was probing. She pretended her phone was vibrating, put it to her ear, with a vague wave of apology at the guard, and mouthed, "Thank you." As she jabbered randomly into the phone, she walked from the gate back to the car, conscious of the way the guard watched her go.
She drove a few hundred yards and stopped to think. Stern had been elderly, frail even. The Hollows, for all its stateliness, had an institutional feel. Retirement home? Maybe. But then, why deny he lived there? She googled local food service providers, ignoring the party caterers, and made a series of calls. In each case, she tried to sound distracted, manic, and a little panicky, calling herself Ashley and asking if they had already processed their order for the Hollows. Two came up empty, but at the third, a company called Newman's, a man's voice, slightly exasperated, said, "Not yet. Why? What is it this time?" "Need to make some changes to Mr. Stern's order," she tried, eyes closed, feeling her way through the deception. "Hold on," said the voice. There was a sigh, some muffled movement, and voices away from the phone. And then he was back. "Stern, you said?" "That's right. Read me what you have there." "Standard continental breakfast, pastrami club lunch with fruit cocktail, and chicken piccata with banana cream pudding dinner." "Yes," said Tamika, thinking hard. "So, what needs changing?" asked the caterer, his irritation mounting. "You can't keep doing this, you know, not without more notice." "They're old people," Tamika ventured. "We have to keep a close eye on their dietary needs." "So what does he want?" "Fish," said Tamika. "Type?" prompted the caterer, still more exasperated. "Well, what's available?" Another sigh. "You know the drill. Long as you guys keep paying, we'll find it. Catfish to swordfish and anything in between." Tamika frowned. The Hollows was turning out to be a very strange place. "Salmon," she said. "Filet. Poached." "Okay. Anything else?" "Hold on," she said, stalling. "Our system is down. Can you run down what else is coming today and for whom?" "Just the two at the Hollows, or all eight of them?" Tamika hesitated. "All eight of them?" "Better give me the lot," she said, pen and notebook poised. More grumbling and sighing, followed by a list of names and some pretty fancy dinner entrees. Filet mignon with goat cheese and pine nuts, Vienna schnitzel, wild mushroom risotto, red snapper and snow peas. With the exception of the only woman on the list who also lived at the Hollows, the other diners lived elsewhere, all separately by the sound of it. But he only mentioned one actual location, as he absently worked through the list, a place called the Silver Birches. Tamika wrote the names down, thanked the caterer for his time and patience, not that he'd shown much, and hung up. She reviewed the names. Horace Evers, Stephen Alberts, Katerina Lundegrass, the other Hollows resident, Albert Billen, Frederick Koss, Carl Jurgens, Max Steigler. 8 elderly residents scattered across at least 2 rest homes being catered by a special service. It was odd. She called Marvin. He answered quickly. She had to speak over his anxious questions. "I want you to see what you can find about these people. Anything that might group them together," she said. "Also this place, the Hollows in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and another called the Silver Birches, also near here." She asked if he'd turned up anything on Stern. "Next to nothing," said Marvin. "It's weird, you know. I see a statement of citizenship from 1945, but after that, nothing. Like he's been wiped from the records, you know? I'll keep poking around." Tamika considered the list of names again, then redialed the caterer. "Ashley again from the Hollows," she said. "What time will you be making your delivery today?" "Usual time, 4, said the caterer. "You wouldn't mind picking me up on the way, would you?" she asked. "I'm having car trouble." Another sigh. "Where?" asked the caterer. She drove to a coffee shop, across the street from a bridal showroom full of lace and fake plastic lilies, yellowing in the sunlit window. She wondered if Jersey Stern had ever been married. She wasn't sure why, but she doubted it. She was on her second coffee when the burner phone rang. Good old Marvin. "So this is really weird," he said. "Those people you told me about, all the same as Stern.
citizenship records in the late 1940s and early 50s, but nothing else. What about the Hollows and the Silver Birches? Retirement homes. No apparent connection.
Tamika's heart sank.
Something interesting with your caterer, though.
What?
Mr. Newman was trained in Paris and Florence, but then joined the military. Lived for a few years in Las Vegas. But it's not clear where he worked. He's been out here 10 years. His catering company is owned by something called Firelight Holdings. But I can't find any other properties, bank records, or tax statements under that name.
So it's a shell company. A well-hidden one. Tamika drummed her fingers on the edge of the table.
You're thinking government, she said.
Not sure who else would bury tax info so completely, said Marvin.
And it looks like the Hollows was built on land that was bought in the late 1940s by what was then called the National Military Establishment.
The DOD.
Right. I'm going to pull some strings and see if I can get a peek inside their more covert files.
Remember what I said, Marvin, Tamika cautioned. Discreet, yeah?
Call me Bond. James Bond.
You mean you'll show up in a tux and a sports car that shoots people out the roof? Let's keep it under the radar, okay?
Understood, said Marvin.
Tamika parked around the corner from the Hollows, then walked a mile back toward town to the junction where she had arranged to meet Newman's van. The driver was middle-aged, but silver-haired, white, and grumpy as expected. Tamika opted for a slightly ditzy